and I'm an attic, and I'd like to welcome you to the main meeting of 12 hours of virtual presented by the San Fernando Valley Area Convention Committee. Again, my name is Matt, and I am an attic, and let's welcome to all the newcomers. Before I get started, I have the announcements to read. I'll start out with these. Please note that you automatically be muted upon entry and will not be able to unmute yourself. The chat function is disabled by hosts and co-hosts and will respond to your requests if you have any questions or concerns. The therapeutic value of one addict helping another is without parallel. If you'd like to give or get support, go to chat, select co-host, and message us for info. If you are new or you're looking for support, please let us know. We want to hear from you, and we'll do our best to help you connect to someone who can help you. Thank you for being here and keep coming back. Our first tradition tells us our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends on NA unity. And it is our collective responsibility to ensure that all our meetings retain an atmosphere of recovery. Our goal is to keep a safe place. Harassment, disruptive, and or inappropriate behavior of any kind will not be tolerated and may result from removal from the meeting at the host, co-host direction, or discretion, I'm sorry. If you are uncomfortable in any way, see offensive or disturbing on anyone's camera, please message the host or co-host with a login name and we'll address it immediately. We ask that you be fully dressed. And Janet, the slide on our donation slide. Okay. Our seventh tradition states that every NA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. The San Fernando Valley area has incurred costs to make this virtual event possible. We have monthly bills and we need startup costs for our 2022 convention, which will hopefully be held live. Any excess will be donated to San Fernando Valley area of NA to help support this still suffering addict. If you'd like to contribute and are able to participate financially, here is the link, sfvacna.org. At the same time, please check out our branded merchandise for sale. And I would say due to the COVID-19, we were unable to have an in-person convention this year. The San Fernando Valley Area Convention of NA 26 will be held on January 21st, 22nd, and 23rd of next year, 2022, at the Los Angeles Burbank Marriott Airport Hotel and Convention Center. If you notice my background, that is the Academy Ballroom where we would be tonight normally. Please check our website, again, sfvacna.org, from time to time for more information. Our convention registration opens on September 1st of this year. And now I would like to introduce our leader for tonight, Bob S. from Florida. Do we have Bob S? We got to unmute him.
He's unmuted.
Go ahead, Bob.
All right, I'm Bob. I'm an addict. Let's get started. Can we open a meeting with a moment of silence followed by the serenity prayer? God. Grant us the serenity
to accept the things
I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. We will now have some readings from our NA literature. Let me have Greg from Chicago read Who is an Addict.
I am Greg. I'm an addict from Cold
Spring, Greg.
Chicago. Who is an addict?
Most of us do not have to think twice about this question. We know our whole life and thinking was centered in drug in one form or another, getting and using and finding ways and means to get more. We live to use and use to live. Very simply, an addict is a man or a woman whose life is controlled by drugs. We are people in the grip of a continuing and progressive illness whose ends are always the same. Jails,
institutions, and death.
Thank you for letting me share, and thank you for your service.
All right, can we have Ruth W. from Las Vegas read what is the NA program?
Unmute. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. What is the Narcotics Anonymous program? NA is a nonprofit fellowship or society of men and women for whom drugs have become a major problem. We are recovering addicts who meet regularly to help each other stay clean. This is a program of complete abstinence from all drugs. There is only one requirement for membership, the desire to stop using. We suggest that you keep an open mind and give yourself a break. Our program is a set of principles written so simply that we can follow them in our daily lives. The most important thing about them is that they work. There is no strings attached to NA. We're not affiliated with any other organizations. We have no initiation fees or dues, no pledges to sign, and no promises to make to anyone. We are not connected with any political, religious, or law enforcement groups and are under no surveillance at any time. Anyone can join us regardless of their age, race, sexual identity, creed, religion, or lack of religion. We are not interested in what or how much you used or who your connections were, what you have done in the past, or how much or how little you have, but only in what you want to do about your problem and how we can help. The newcomer is the most important person at any meeting because we can only keep what we have by giving it away. We have learned from our group experience that those who keep coming to our meetings regularly stay clean. Thank you for letting me share. Thank you.
Can we have Stuart D. from Baltimore read why are we here?
I don't see him here. So it's somebody, Sergio has raised his hands. Why don't we have Sergio do it? Sergio, you have to unmute yourself. There you go.
Sergio, I am an addict.
Hi, Sergio.
Why are we here? Before coming to the fellowship of NA, we cannot manage our own lives. We cannot live and enjoy life as other people do. We had to have something different, and we thought we had found it in drugs. We placed their use ahead of the welfare of our families, our wives, husband, and our children. We had to have drugs at all costs. We did many people great harm, but most of all, we harmed ourselves. Through our inability to accept personal responsibilities, we were actually creating our own problems. We seemed to be incapable of facing life on its own terms.
Next slide, please.
Yeah, next slide, please.
Most of us realized.
Most of us realized that in our addiction, we were slowly committing suicide. But addiction is such a cunning enemy of life that we had lost the power to do anything about it. Many of us ended up in jail or sought help through medicine, religion, and psychiatry. None of these methods was sufficient for us. Our disease always resurfaced or continued to progress until in desperation we sought help from each other in Narcotics Anonymous. After coming to NA, we realized we're sick people. We suffer from a disease from which there is no known cure. It can, however, be arrested at some point and recovery is then possible. Thank you for letting me read.
Thank you, Sergio. Can we have Brandon J. from SFV, San Fernando Valley, read how it works?
Hi, my name is Brandon. I'm an addict.
Hey, Brandon.
How it works. If you want what we have, if you want what we have to offer and are willing to make the effort to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. These are the principles that made our recovery possible. One, we admitted that we were powerless over our addiction and that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Four, we made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, we admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, we were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, we humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, we made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, we made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, we continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, we sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for the knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to addicts and to practice these principles in all our affairs. This sounds like a big order, and we can't do it all at once. We didn't become addicted in one day, so remember, easy does it. There's one thing more than anything else that will defeat us in our recovery. This is an attitude of indifference or intolerance towards spiritual principles. Three of these that are indispensable are honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. With these, we are well on our way. We feel that our approach to the disease of addiction is completely realistic, for the therapeutic value of one addict helping another is without parallel. We feel that our way is practical, for one addict can best understand and help another addict. We believe that the sooner we face our problems within our society, in everyday living, just that much faster do we become acceptable, responsible, and productive members of that society. The only way to keep from returning to active addiction is not to take that first drug. If you are like us, you know that one is too many and a thousand's never enough. We put great emphasis on this, for we know that when we use drugs in any form or substitute one for another, we release our addiction all over again. Thinking of alcohol as different from other drugs has caused a great many addicts to relapse. Before we came to NA, many of us viewed alcohol separately, but we cannot afford to be confused about this. Alcohol is a drug. We are people with a disease of addiction who must abstain from all drugs in order to recover.
All right. All right, thank you. Can we have Kristen Y. from County Line read the 12 traditions of NA?
I don't see her here either.
Here, my name's Kristen. I'm an addict.
She's there.
Hi. The 12 traditions of NA. We keep what we have only with vigilance, and just as freedom for the individual comes from the 12 steps, so freedom for the group springs from our traditions. As long as the ties that bind us together are stronger than those that would tear us apart, all will be well. One, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends on NA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there's but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Three, the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop using. Four, each group should be autonomous, except in matters affecting other groups or NA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry the message to the addict who still suffers. Six, an NA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the NA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, or prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Seven, every NA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Eight, Narcotics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. Nine, NA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10, Narcotics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the NA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. And 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
Thank you.
Oh, wait, there's more. Understanding these traditions comes slowly over a period of time. We pick up information as we talk to members and various groups. It usually isn't until we get involved with service that someone points out that personal recovery depends on NA unity, and that unity depends on how well we follow our traditions. The 12 traditions of NA are not negotiable. They are the guidelines that keep our fellowship alive and free. By following these guidelines in our dealings with others and society at large, we avoid many problems. That is not to say that our traditions eliminate all problems. We still have to face difficulties as they arise, communication problems, differences of opinion, internal controversies, and troubles with individuals and groups outside the fellowship. However, when we apply these principles, we avoid some of the pitfalls. Many of our problems are like those that our predecessors had to face. Their hard-won experience gave birth to the traditions, and our own experience has shown that these principles are just as valid today as they were when these traditions were formulated. Our traditions protect us from the internal and external forces that can destroy us. They are truly the ties that bind us together. It is only through understanding and application that they work.
Thank you, Kristen. And could I have Amanda F. from the West End read We Do Recover?
Yes, my name is Amanda and I'm an addict. We do recover. When at the end of the road we find that we can no longer function as a human being, either with or without drugs, we all face the same dilemma. What is there left to do? There seems to be this alternative, either go on as best we can to the bitter end, jails, institutions, or death, or find a new way to live. In years gone by, very few addicts ever had this last choice. Those who are addicted today are more fortunate. For the first time in man's entire history, a simple way has been proving itself in the lives of many addicts. It is available to us all. This is a simple, spiritual, not religious program known as Narcotics Anonymous. Thank you.
Thank you, Amanda. Again, my name is Bob, and I'm an addict, and I'd like to thank all the people who read. Thank you for your contribution to this point. I'd like to take a point at this time to thank Matt for contacting me and asking me to lead this meeting. It's kind of interesting being that I grew up in most of my recovery in Southern California. I got clean in Southern California in 1978. And I left in 2010 and eventually found my way down here to Florida in 2018. There's a lot of people on the screen. I haven't seen all the screens since it's jumped over 400 people, but there's a lot of people out there that are friends of mine who've known me for most of, if not all of my recovery. Some are around that are out there who've known me all these 42 plus years. And then there are a lot of people who I have known all of their recovery. You know, it's a privilege and an honor to share at this convention. I've been to that convention many times at that center down there by Burbank Airport. You know, I spent a lot of years as a special worker at the Narcotics Anonymous World Service Office. A lot of you know that, you know. I miss the people there. I miss all of my friends. You know, you never... You know, we've lost so many people, and sharing in recovery over Zoom, it has its pluses, but nothing. You know, I miss the interaction personally with people. You know, it's real difficult for us to reach out to newcomers. If they show up in a Zoom meeting, of course, we talk to them. We try to chat, give them a number, get them to call us, but we can't. We're not there in person, so we can't kind of press that issue, but we do the best we can. And it's I'm of an age group, my wife and I are in that category where, you know, we're not going in a room with people right now because we're trying to save our lives. You know, we were given these lives through our recovery. Thank God for Narcotics Anonymous and the people that were here before I got here. You know, all of the sponsors I've had all the way, the ones who have passed on, and the one I have currently, Tom M. from Hawaii, you know, these guys have led me and guided me and helped me in my recovery. But not just that, people that I sponsored over the years, and it's been a lot of them, they've done more for me probably than I've done for them. Let's be honest about it. You know, that's what we do. We help one another. We hold one another up when in our darkest times. And we cheer each other during our brightest times, you know. I'm grateful that I was introduced to Narcotics Anonymous way back when there was hardly any meetings. That west side of L.A., the West End, Santa Monica, Venice. We only had four NA meetings a week when I got clean. That was it. You know, the rest of the meetings were scattered all over, very sparsely, except in the valley there. You had the Survivors Club that met every day, three times a day, you know, until they couldn't handle one another anymore and decided to cut it off. And then they tried it again. But that original Survivors Club, there were a lot of people there that are predecessors, the ones who helped develop this fellowship. They were sitting in those chairs in that meeting. I saw Hank in the meeting earlier. I know Hank was in those meetings, you know. So, you know, I'm not going to take a lot of time. I just wanted to share my gratitude for the Fellowship of Narcotics Anonymous, you people in the San Fernando Valley for reaching out for me and asking me to lead this meeting. You know, all of you have played an integral part in my recovery. My wife is here. She got clean in the San Gabriel Valley. Once she got to the San Gabriel Valley from another place, but she got her early recovery is from San Gabriel. You know, she's here in the house with me. She's in the meeting. Thank God. We've been together 16 years now, and it seems like it was only yesterday we met in a meeting down in Anaheim. So with that, I'm going to pass the baton over, and I'd like to now introduce our speaker for tonight, Bob M. from Pennsylvania.
My name is Bob, and I'm an addict.
Hey, Bob.
I want to thank the committee for giving me the opportunity to carry NA's message. It's always an honor to be able to do that. I'd like to share tonight about love. I mean, this recovery is all about love. So if you're a newcomer and you haven't been feeling love lately, we welcome you here because we're going to love you up till you can love yourself. And I'm going to speak primarily to the newcomer tonight. I want you to feel that love. And if you're an addict of my kind, which simply means that you're powerless over the disease of addiction and you're clean tonight, something's happened. Being clean and being an addict and powerless are opposites. And so if you're sitting here clean with one day or 50 years, you've received a gift. And that gift I choose to call the gift of recovery. And when I got my gift of recovery, I sure as hell didn't deserve it. I went to my first institution when I was 12, my last one when I was 27. I told you that I'm an addict. What I didn't tell you is that my grandfather was an alcoholic. My father was an addict. I'm an addict, and three of my four kids are in recovery. Here's the wonderful part of this whole thing, is we get to break the cycle of addiction here. So if you're a newcomer and you're thinking, well, man, I don't deserve recovery. I'm not worthy of recovery. Think of the people that are going to come beyond you. Think of the children you may have, and you're going to give them a chance to live clean. You're going to give them a chance to find happiness in their life and not have to chase a drug all day long, not have to go to institutions and pay the prices that we pay. And so if you're clean tonight, you've gotten that gift. And right now there's an addict waking up sick because he couldn't save a wake-up shot. There's an addict doing a sex act for somebody to get a bag of dope. There's an addict putting a gun to somebody to get enough money to get a couple of rocks. And there's somebody sitting over in Pelican Bay knowing there's no money on the books and nobody's going to come to see him tomorrow. And there's a baby being born to a crack mother whose first breath will be in the throes of an act of addiction because she couldn't put that pipe down long enough to let that baby's first breath be free. And there's an addict whose next shot will be their last shot. And there's an addict who can't live with this disease 1 minute more. It's going to take his own life. But for the grace of God and the 12 steps and 12 traditions of a fellowship called Narcotics Anonymous and that gift of recovery, that addict could be you and it could be me. See, I think we're the truly blessed people. I think that God came to me and gave me this gift of recovery. And when I say the word God, believe me, when I got here, I did not believe in God. In fact, I cursed God. I used to refer to God as hope dope. But if you've gotten that gift, just hang with me and maybe you'll come to believe. We don't have to believe this stuff to have it work either if you're a newcomer. You don't have to believe that if you step out in front of a truck 70 miles an hour that it will hurt you. All you have to do is step out in front of that truck and that truck will prove it to you. That's the way that works here. If you don't have to believe this stuff. You just keep coming to the meetings. You try to get a sponsor. You pick a home group. and you will eventually come to believe, and you'll find that this stuff really, really works for you. I came into recovery at the lowest point of my life. In fact, I didn't actually come seeking recovery. I thought I was crazy. I went to a mental health center, and in my time, they didn't have detoxes. Now today, you know, if you cleaned up, in my time, you went to jail. You cleaned up in a jail cell, and they didn't give you anything. You went cold turkey. Today, man, they'll send a car for you to pick you on up, man. Today, it's almost a celebrity status to go to rehab center, and I think that's a part of the blessing that we have, because we are deserving of a life of joy and of happiness. And in active addiction, I never had any of that. So if you're new, we just say welcome. We love you. Keep coming back. You know, when I got here, I told you I didn't believe in God, and it was at the lowest point of my life. I was living on the street. I had not bathed or washed for weeks. As I went into that mental health center, I told them I was crazy. That's what I was there for. I didn't go to kick drugs. I went because I was chemically unbalanced. And I knew that they had drugs there that could help me get chemically balanced again, and then I could go on without using, without paying the prices I was paying. And they suggested that I go to a detox. I didn't know what the hell a detox was at the time, but I got one of those gifts. I couldn't think of any place else to go. I couldn't think of anything else to do. So I went into detox, and I began my recovery, and I eventually went to a treatment program. You know, I started out by saying this is all about love, and sometimes when love comes to you, it doesn't always come to you with the oh baby stuff. And believe me, I love oh baby stuff. It comes to you with a guy walking up to you, taking his finger and pointing it in your chest and telling you, I'm going to be your sponsor. Because that's what happened to me. This little guy walked up to me at a meeting, and he took his finger and he poked at my chest. He said, I'm going to be your sponsor. And I said, I didn't ask you to be my sponsor. Like there was a long line of people waiting for that job, and he kind of jumped in the front. And, you know, I'm not afraid of bad people. I ran dope up in the projects. In fact, I was that crazy that I didn't know I was bad. People weren't afraid of me because I was a badass. They were afraid of me because I was crazy. So that white boy's got to be crazy to run them drugs up here in this project. But anyway, I knew that this guy was crazy when he took his finger and poked at my chest a second time and said to me, I didn't ask you if I was could be your sponsor. I told you I'm going to be your sponsor because you need a sponsor and you don't know that you need a sponsor yet. So I'm going to sponsor you until you decide if you want somebody else. And I'm going to pick you up tomorrow night at 8 o'clock for a meeting and your ass better be ready. And I said, okay. I had that man for a sponsor for 14 and a half years until he died. And he's the one who taught me what NA's message was. That any addict, and we say any addict because I thought I was a special addict. I thought you might get strung out, but I wasn't going to get strung out. I thought you might go to jail because you did things that you needed to support your addiction. I thought you were kind of lame, but I was kind of cool. I could handle this shit. So we say any addict because then I reached a point in my active addiction where I knew I was an addict. And what addicts do is we do drugs. And I just kind of accepted that because I tried to kick and quit so many times. My idea of kicking dope was to go down to Washington, D.C., hit 14th Street, buy a couple of good buy bags, go across the river to my brother's apartment, chew Valium, and drink beer. And I thought that's how I cleaned up from dope. I did not know anything about total abstinence. I didn't know really anything about addiction. But so we say any addict because I thought that I was different than everybody else and that this wouldn't really work for me because I had tried to kick a lot of times and just never was ever successful at it. So if you've tried to stop using and you haven't been able to do that, you're in the right place. See, because I'm powerless. I'm still as powerless today, and I'm clean 46 years. I'm as powerless today as I was the day I walked in those rooms. But through Narcotics Anonymous and the love that we get here and the gift of the 12 steps, I've managed to stay clean and put a life together. And you can do that too. And you can do that too. And so that's why we say any addict. And then the next part of our message that he taught me was that I would lose the desire to use. I never thought that was possible. I thought if you were clean more than a day or two, you know, you were something special. And I didn't believe that you could stay clean. And I didn't believe that for a long time. But I was that sick when I got here that I kept coming to meetings. Because for the first time, although I was sick as hell, crazy as hell, I was staying clean. I didn't feel good about it, but I was staying clean. And he told me that if I did these simple things, if I get up in the morning and hit my knees and ask God to give me a day clean, well, that was the first thing I had a problem with because I didn't believe in God. But he said if I would, I would call him every day. If I went to a meeting every day, if I didn't pick off, if my ass fell off, if I would do something kind for somebody throughout the day. Now, I didn't have to find the cure for cancer. I just had to get somebody a cup of coffee or open the door for them or carry a package or just do some little kind thing and not tell anybody. See, because if you tell people what acts of kindness you do, you're feeding your ego. But if you do it in silence, you're feeding your relationship with your spirit and with the God of your understanding. So he said, and you do those things, and you go to a meeting, when you go home at night, you hit your knees and you thank God for giving you a day clean. I told you I didn't believe in God, and I was about 6 months clean, and I was still sick. And I sat out in back of Holy Spirit Hospital one night before a meeting with him. We were talking. I told him, I said, look, Smoke, I know I'm an addict, and I know that picking back up is not going to answer my problem, but I can't live like this. You know, if I hear one more person say happy, joyous, and free, I'm going to drive a stake through their damn heart, because I'm not happy, joyous, and free, man. I'm white knuckle, and I'm sick all the time. I just can't seem to get any peace of mind. The serenity that people talk about, I'm not getting any of that. And so I'm not going to pick up, and I'm going to take my life. I'm just going to take my life. And he said, Bobby, if you're that desperate to do that, man, just go home tonight and hit your knees and ask God to give you some kind of a contact in the morning when you open your eyes, so that you know that there's some spiritual force at play here. Now, I didn't believe in God, right? And so that was a direction that was hard for me to take. But after 6 months of that man sponsoring me, giving me rides to a meeting, giving me his irreplaceable gift of his time, because when he gave me his time, he's never, ever going to get that time back, invite me into his home, feed me dinner. He just was loving me and kind to me, and I came to believe in him. Seeing in our literature, just for today, we say, just for today, I'll have somebody in it. I'll have faith in somebody in N.A., who wants to help me in my recovery. That was my guy. I had faith in him, or I didn't believe in God, but I had faith in my sponsor. I knew he believed in God, and I knew he really wanted to help me in my recovery, and I decided to take his direction, and I went home, and I hit my knees. I didn't know whether I was praying to the wall, praying to the ceiling. I had no idea what the hell I was doing, but I was doing it because he gave me a direction to do it. And I went to sleep, and I woke up the next morning, and I opened my eyes anticipating this spiritual contact, and it didn't happen. I don't know whether I expected angels or choirs or blinking lights or some shit, you know, band maybe, something just coming through the room to let me know, hey, I made a contact. Nothing happened. So I went up and I went to work. And about 3 weeks later, I was sitting in a meeting, and all of a sudden it dawned on me. For the last 3 weeks, I hadn't wanted to kill myself. I started to feel better about myself. I started to find the hope that people talked about in these rooms. And I called him immediately. And when he used to point stuff out to me, he'd say, Bobby, you're not going to find God in any kind of metaphysical way until you can see God in reality, into the sunrise, into the sunset, into the order of nature, until you see him in a practical kind of way. You're not going to see God metaphysically. So I called him and I said, man, I think I made this spiritual contact. And he said, nah, it's just a coincidence. Because whenever he pointed that stuff out to me, that's what I used to say, just a coincidence. I always denied God in my life in early recovery. See, we get this gift of recovery when we're least deserving of it. That's what makes it loving. It wasn't that we deserved it. It's that whatever force, and you can call it God, you can call it power of recovery, you can call it whatever you choose to call it, but there is a force that permeates the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous that helps us stay clean. I choose to call it the gift of recovery. And I said, no, man, I made this contact. And he said, no, just coincidence. Once I made that spiritual contact, I've never lost it. I've lost a lot in my life. I've lost homes. I've lost money. I lost a woman that I was married to for 40 years. Just because you stay clean does not mean that you live pain-free. Man, I have hurt, and I have been in pain, and I have been to a point in my life where the only thing that I could cling to was this gift of recovery. The only thing that I could think to not pick up was that I was gifted, that some force in life had gifted me with this ability to stay clean, even though I was a powerless addict. And it kept me from killing myself, and it kept me from killing other people. And it gave me the hope to go on to the last part of our spiritual message. And that's that we find a new way to live. And this guy showed me a new way to live. See, when I got here, I didn't know how to live. I told you I was a child of an addict. I grew up in a home that was violent. I went to juvenile court, I think, first time when I was 10 or 12 years old. I was institutionalized when I was 12. But I grew up not with any kind of role models. I was raised in a religion where I was shamed. I was made to feel less than. And the hypocrisy of the people who were teaching me became very evident to me. And that's what turned me off to God. They spiritually abused me. They took my ability to reach outside myself or to reach inside myself and find a strength that I didn't ordinarily possess, that I knew that came from a force other than my will. It my spirituality allows me to transcend will. It takes me into a different realm and a different kind of dimension. And when you're spiritually abused, people take that from you. I mistakenly took personalities over the principles of God and the principles of religion. I looked to the people who were teaching me who were horrible, instead of looking to the spiritual message that was involved in that faith. And so, you know, I wasn't too keen on how to live. I had no role models, and when you're in institutions, you learn to see the negative. You learn to shame other people to make yourself feel better. And so I didn't know how to have relationships with people. And I was a big guy. People knew I ran the project. People knew that I was scary. And I would ask people, hey, give me a ride to a meeting. They'd say, oh, no, I don't think I'm going to a meeting tonight. Because they were afraid to get into a small, confined space like a car with me. But this guy wasn't, man. This guy was determined to teach me this new way to live. But before he did that, he really wanted me to understand what that gift of recovery is, and that's what he had me focused on. He would continually ask me, what separates you from the addict who's still using? How, if you're powerless, can you be clean today? And he would ask me those kind of questions, and we would go round and round about stuff, and coincidence was my biggest rationale for that stuff. But he focused me on that gift of recovery for a long time, and I came into a fellowship before Narcotics Anonymous, because there was no Narcotics Anonymous in the area that I was at. In fact, I think there was probably only a couple of meetings on the East Coast when I got clean, And I hung around with five or six other addicts. And if you saw one of us, you saw the rest of us. And they were all like 8, 9 months clean. And they were working the 9th step or the 11th step. And they would say, Bob, what step are you working, man? I'd have to mumble because my sponsor didn't put me on that step. He just kept me back focused on this gift of recovery. But one day, I didn't really want to learn these steps to better my life or change my life or find a new way to live. I wanted to learn the steps because I knew this guy was like the guru, man. He was like the spiritual guy around the program, and he had really good shit. And if he gave me that shit, I could really lay it on my peers and really elevate myself within my little circle there. So I didn't want it to self-improve, and I guess he knew that too. But one day, after I worked on the gift of recovery, he talked about honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness as being a necessary part of my recovery. And so as I go on with my share, just listen for the honesty, listen for the openness, listen for the willingness. Because when I got here, I wasn't open-minded. I wasn't particularly willing. And I had a friend, Dick B, and I, we tried to stay honest for a whole day, and we would laugh at the end of the day because neither one of us were able to do that. So if you're not capable of doing all this stuff that I'm talking about, that's okay, man. We strive for progress rather than perfection here, because I sure as hell don't walk on water, and I still make a lot of mistakes. But I was telling you, I was running with these young guys and one young lady, and I wanted to work the steps, and I kept asking, man, give me the steps, give me the steps. One day he says to me, would you really like to learn to work the first step? Oh, yeah, man. Yeah, I'm really excited. Tell me. I said, all right, for your first step, Bob, what I want you to do is tell me how they catch monkeys in South America. What does that have to do with recovery? He said, I didn't ask you that. I asked you, do you know how they do it? Well, I'm going to tell you, I looked in all the pamphlets in the little white book, and there wasn't anything about catching monkeys. I even read literature of the other fellowship and in the Bible, and there was nothing in either of those two books that had anything to do with catching monkeys in South America, and I did not know how to do it. If I don't know something, I'm likely to make some shit up. But I couldn't figure out how they did it, and so I said to him, I don't know. He said, Bob, that's the beginning of learning. That's the beginning of opening your mind to a new way to live, a new way to think, a new way to behave yourself. And he said, I'm going to show you. I'm going to teach you how they do it. And he said, they take a bottle, and it's like this cup. It has a little loop on it that they tie a rope to, and tie the other end of the rope to a tree. And the hunter takes a nut, and he shows it to the monkeys up in the tree. And then he drops it in the bottle, and he sets the bottle down, and he walks away. And those monkeys come running out of the tree like a bunch of addicts that's the last bag of dope on the earth. And quote, unquote, the lucky monkey who grabs the jar, here's how they catch monkeys in South America. The opening of that jar is such that he can reach his hand in, but the minute he grabs the nut, he makes a fist, and he can't get the fist out of the bottle. What does that monkey have to do to be free? Let go of the nut. This is an addict monkey. This monkey ain't letting go of shit. This monkey, not only does he have a nut, he's got a bottle and a rope until he hits the end of that rope. I don't know about you, but I hit the end of that rope a lot, man. I just kept repeating stuff over and over and hitting the end of the rope all the time. When that doesn't work, what do you think the monkey does? When a hunter starts to walk towards a monkey, the monkey gets nasty. Lifts it, shows its teeth, growls, lunges, does anything. When that doesn't work and the hunter keeps coming, what do you think the addict or the monkey does? He starts to cry. He said, everybody else gets a nut but me. What does the monkey have to do to be free? Let go of the nut. The hunter walks up with a lead pipe and hits the monkey alongside the head and gives that monkey an immediate change of consciousness. And when that monkey changes that consciousness, he's already in the bag. The hunter grabs him and puts him in the bag. My sponsor looked at me and he said to me, Bobby, for your first step, I want you to tell me what you and that monkey have in common. What are the things that keep taking you back into that spoon, man? What is it? Why do you keep going back and doing the same things? When are you going to start to give yourself a chance? When are you going to start to admit your powerlessness? When are you going to start to look for a force outside yourself, be it me, be it a home group, be it the guys or ladies you're running with? Look for other people to help you stay clean. When are you going to let go of all that stuff that you're carrying around that keeps you going back in the spoon? And that was the beginning. That was the beginning of my first step. After I got that first step, he taught me principles in that first step of surrender, being willing to just say, hey, I can't, God can, I think I'll let him. And to reach a willingness to do whatever it took. See, when we say acceptance in that first step, we're accepting the fact that when I got clean, I would say to him, oh, man, I am so miserable. I don't have a job. I don't, I'm bitching up. I'm crying. I'm feeling really bad. He'd say, that's good. That's good. That's the way you should feel. Your life's a wreck. But if you keep sticking around, you're going to get a little hope that it's going to get better. If you pick back up, it never gets better. But if you stick around, get through all the pain, all the stuff you're going through, Bobby, I'm going to be here with you. You never have to do this alone. We'll get you a job. We'll help you get your career going. We'll do the kinds of things that you that need to be done to help you stay clean. But you're going to have to accept the situation for where you're at and what you're doing. So I learned surrender. I learned acceptance. And then I thought I had the first step. And he said, well, what about the second half of the first step? And I, what the hell are you talking about? He said, your life's unmanageable. He said, the first step is we're going to start to put manageability back in your life. You're going to keep regular hours. You're going to eat properly. You're going to sleep properly. And when you go to a meeting, I don't want to hear you talk and bitch up about this or that or what you're going through. Oh, what I want to hear you talk about is what's working in your life. What are you doing for yourself today? What are you doing for your recovery today? And you will go to every meeting and you will address yourself, tell people your name in the group and that you're an addict, and then say something positive that you're doing to yourself. I can remember in the very beginning saying, my name is Bob, I'm an addict, and I bathed every day for 2 weeks. I've taken a shower every day for the last 2 weeks because in early recovery, that was an accomplishment for me. See, when you're new in recovery, man, just grab to the little things that are getting better for you. Start to see the hope. Start to see the change. Start to look to changing your life and starting to put some manageability into your life. And that's what he helped me do in that first step. I didn't think I could work again. And he drove me to job interviews. See, if he asked me to do something, he was there to support me. That's what sponsorship is all about. If he asked me to do something, he was there for me. I want to take just a second, though, and talk to some of the old guys. You got to be careful, old guys, if you're sponsoring these young guys, because they come into the rooms with all different colored hair and they got stuff sticking out of their body all over the place. And you're prone to say stupid shit to them like, if you stay clean for a year, I'll dye my hair purple. Well, I'm going to tell you something. Purple is definitely not my color, because I started to sponsor a bunch of young guys and the guy stayed clean. And I dyed my hair and my beard purple. My wife loved it, put earrings in. I went to the Starbucks I usually go to, and these young girls that see me every morning in a suit said, oh, man, that is so cool, Bob. That is so really, really good. I think that's amazing. And I'd say, no, man, no, this is going to be out of here in another day or two. So the other thing is, I would go to dance, and all these young guys were young and handsome, and all the young ladies would come around, and I'd get that little feeling going and forget who I was for a second, and one of them would say to me, you remind me of my dad. And that would just put me right back into the spot where I needed to be. But you know what? I tell people I had to move up here where I live now and find a home group. So I started to go visiting meetings, and I found my home group because I went to the meeting, and all the guys in that meeting were young and handsome and strong. And the women in that home group, my home group, are drop dead gorgeous. I mean, beautiful. I knew right away I would fit into that group. And that's been my home group. And I'll tell you what, I joke about that, but when my wife died, I was married for 40 years. I had a tremendous marriage. And that was another gift. That was another gift that I got from a loving God. And I'll tell you a little bit about how that worked in a bit, but I've been blessed, man. I have just been blessed, but when my wife died, and excuse me, cause man, I still, I still get lost in that. I went to my home group, and these young girls, 20, 25 years old, sitting beside me, putting their arm around me and saying, if you need to talk, you can call me. You know, if you just need to talk a little bit, give me a call. Do you want to go to coffee? Do you want me to take you to Panera's for a cup of coffee? My home group reached out to me and loved me. See, because when you're in recovery, man, you're going to hit those times of low points in your life when you are the addict who still suffers. And if you've got a home group that you have a relationship, they will love you. I had guys from my home group today and guys from my sponsors. I'm moving, so I moved a whole house full of furniture today. Well, let me put that in perspective. They moved a whole house full of furniture today. I supervised. But they showed up. We show up for each other here. So if you're a newcomer, you're going to find out that, man, you're going to make friends here that are real friends. And when you need them, they show up for you. I've had to sleep on somebody's couch when I had one of those deep, hot, loving, meaningful, early NA relationships that ended and I was gut shot. And I would say to somebody, oh, man, look, can I just sleep on your couch? Can I just, I just can't be alone. See, that's the beauty of this thing is that we are never alone. We're never, ever alone here. And so I found the home group and I had a sponsor and I started to work the steps and I started to come to believe. I started to come to believe that there was that higher power, that God was working in my life. And what I did in my second step was my sponsor taught me what was valuable. See, I didn't know how to live. I didn't know what I should value. I didn't know that relationships were important. I didn't know that you didn't fuck over your friends. I didn't know that you didn't screw your best friend's girlfriend. I didn't know those things. I was taught those things with my sponsor, my second step. He started to teach me how to be a loving person, how to be a kind person, how to develop a relationship with a guy that I could understand. And he asked me the most important question in recovery I've ever been asked. He asked me what kind of man I wanted to be. I didn't have a clue what kind of man I wanted to be. Not a clue. And what he did is he had me look at all the men in my life and write something about each of those men that I liked. Now, I had learned to look at people and find the bullshit in their life, but it taught me to start to look for the good in people, to start to find out things that I could emulate, things that I could be like, things that I liked in other people. And when I had a whole sheet of stuff from people that I, men that I knew, he said to me, Bobby, that's the man you really want to be because those values are already in you. If you can recognize those values in somebody else, you can definitely recognize them in yourself. And so I started out to be that kind of man. And he said, let's just pick one thing and work on it. I said, well, you know what? The sexuality kind of shit's a little raggedy here. He said, you know what? You ain't got a chance at that, Bob. Just don't go there yet. Why don't you do something that you're going to be successful at? Why don't you work at just being kind? And so for the last 46 years, I've been working on just being kind. And some days, man, I think I got it. And then somebody will pull out my lane in the passing lane. And I know I still have work to do. You know, in my third step, he taught me to trust God. To turn my will and my life over by simply doing the next right thing for the next right reason and not to overthink everything and not to scheme and plan and manipulate and try to control everything. Just do what I believed was right and to learn from my mistakes. He said, you're allowed to make mistakes in recovery. Picking up is not a mistake. Picking up is insanity. You know, wrecking your car, that's a mistake. Not paying your bills and getting your electric shut off, that's a mistake. You learn from those things. You learn from your mistake in your third step. But he said, you learn to do the next right thing for the next right reason, and you learn to trust God in your life. See, and that God came to me in my lowest point. And here's a couple of significant things that happened to me in my third step. I did not have a high school degree when I came into recovery, and I was strung out in the hospital, and a doctor and a minister who had lost his daughter took a liking to me. And the doctor said to me, Bob, if you want to go to medical school, I will help pay for your education, and I will help you get in medical school. And the minister said to me, Bob, I want to introduce you to a black guy, and if the two of you can get along, I'll give you $250,000 to start a program for kids who commit serious chronic and violent offenses. I said, man, look, I love the brother. And another young man and I started a treatment program for kids who committed serious chronic and violent offenses. I probably worked with 100 kids who either were victims of homicide or committed homicide, which never had to hurt a kid. When you work in God's will works in your life. And that's happened to me. We built one of the most successful programs for kids in the country. We got a lot of recognition for that. And I did that for 35 years. The other thing was that I was talked about love, and I love the Oh Baby, Oh Baby. And I met my wife at a program that I was running. She came to my office one day and asked if she could ask me for a favor. And I said, as beautiful as you are, you can ask me anything you want to see. We have an A game as addicts, man. When we turn on a charm, we can be some charming sons of guns, man. So I turn on a little charm, and we went out, and I took her to the best place in town, which my partner's father was a maitre d' in. This woman grinned the whole way through dinner. I gave her a ride home. We picked up her daughter, and her daughter said, hey, Mommy, we got to get home quick because the other daughter, there's a boy trying to break in. And Sue said, well, Bob will handle it. And I'm thinking, man, this is the first time I've been out with this woman, and I got to put my thug suit on and get rid of the little thug. And I did. But I kissed her goodnight, and I said, I'll call you. And I didn't call her. And I got a note from her that said, thank you for a wonderful evening. Are you the kind of man that tells a woman you're going to call and then doesn't? And I showed that to my sponsor, and he said, are you that kind of man? Are you that kind of man? See, when love comes to you, sometimes you don't. I just never recognized what it was. So I said, no, I'm not that kind of man. I don't want to be that kind of man. So I called her and I invited her for dinner. She came to my house. She gave me flowers. I've never had anybody do that for me. And I knew, honestly, I knew at that time in my life that she was the woman that I was meant to be with. And we spent 40 years together. We raised family together. She was not an addict, but she opened her heart and her home to addicts in recovery. And we had a wonderful life until she passed away. A lot of times in our third step, we don't talk about the second half of the third step, what it's like to live in the care of a loving God, what it's like to live without anxiety or without fear, to just do the next right thing and know that God is working in your life. And there are times when I don't see God working. I don't realize it, but I keep walking in faith. I'm walking blind, but I've had enough experience in my recovery to know that I can trust God to do those kinds of things. I'm moving now. It's the first time I'm going to be homeless after Thursday of this week since I've been homeless in recovery. I'm going to go live with one of my friends in Connecticut. And that's the other thing you're going to find in recovery. You're going to find friends. Man, I had 13 people show up to help me move today. Four of those guys drove down from Connecticut to help me. Two people drove up from down Lancaster County to give me a hand. We reach out for each other here. We help each other. And that's what living in the care of a loving God is. You don't have to figure everything out yourself. You just do the next right thing, and God will figure it out for you. And so in my fourth step, he taught me to call my life into question. I don't know whether this has happened to you, but I've gotten into arguments with people where my mouth disengages from my brain and takes on a life of its own. And the only thing I'm interested in is winning the argument or putting the person down or doing hateful shit with my mouth. Once I know what kind of man I want to be in my fourth step, and I did the traditional four-step inventory, but the principle that I practice out of that four step is one of being able to call my life into question. Whenever I'm in an unmanageable situation, when things are not going my way or there's tension or confusion, I can always find myself by asking myself, am I being the kind of man I want to be? Am I being the kind of man that I believe God wants me to be in that situation? And I can always change the situation because I don't have to change the answer to a column of 100 numbers, you don't have to change every number. You only have to change one number. And the best number that you can change is you. That's my sponsor taught me that. You can always gain control of yourself if you work a principle in the fourth step, where you call your life into question, where you ask yourself, are you living to the standard of the man and God's standard that you really want to be? In my fifth step, he taught me about secrets, living with integrity, being the man you say you are, being honest. And in that fifth step, when I shared with him all the things that I've done that were horrible, just that I was ashamed of, and he accepted me, he said, Bobby, I will love you no matter what you've done, and I will love you no matter what you do. What I can't do is I can't keep you from the pain of the error of your judgments, but I'm going to try to give you my experience, and if you take it, it will serve you well because it works for me. I'm going to give you what works for me. And so out of that fifth step, what I learned was not to shame other people, not to be judgmental of other people, to accept other people for who they are, as I was accepted for who I am and loved for who I am. Loved in spite of all that crazy shit that I did in my fifth step. To be accepted unconditionally in that fifth step. We worry about taking that fifth step when we're new and we're working it and we're trying it and you're afraid to share it with somebody. But when you get that unconditional acceptance and love, man, it just frees you. It frees you. In my sixth step, becoming entirely ready sometimes comes a lot from pain. When we hurt enough, we change. But the other thing that he taught me in my sixth step was to want better for myself. He said, Bob, you can go to massage parlors. You can go, with prostitutes. You can do all that. And I'm not going to tell you to stop. But what I'm going to tell you is you'll never have a loving, meaningful, deep relationship when you're doing that stuff. They're incompatible. What he taught me was to want better for myself, to want a better life than I had grown up in, to want a better life than I had seen, to want a life beyond my wildest dreams, to want to be a better person. And he taught me the value of that in my sixth step, to want better. And then in my seventh step, he taught me to engage with God in the process, to humble myself, to ask God to help me change, help me become a better man. Help me put my anger and my feelings and my emotions into perspective. Let me be a kind and loving person, God. And then God, I work with God with that. And how I work with God is I read spiritual material. I pray and meditate in the morning. I pray and meditate throughout my day. I reach out to try to help other people. I do those things that feed the spirit, not the ego. You want to try to learn how to feed your spirit. And that's what I got out of that seventh step. In my eighth step, I learned to I learned that I couldn't really take an eighth step unless I had a change of heart in my sixth and seventh step. Because if you try to make an amends to people on steps 8 and 9 without having had a change of heart, it rings funny. I mean, think of all the times you said, "Oh, I'm never going to do that again. I'm sorry." And people know you're full of shit. But when you have that spiritual change in steps 6 and 7, you have that change of heart, it prepares you to approach people who you have damaged, people whose trust you violated, and you get to help restore their ability to believe in themselves. Because if they believed in you and you screwed them over, man, they start to not trust their own judgment, and you can help people restore their sense of judgment. And in doing that, you can't do something for other people without doing something for yourself. In my 10th step, he taught me to go to a meeting and to look for somebody who needed a hug. See, we keep what we have by giving it away. We do that daily inventory. We do it. If we want to stay vigilant in our recovery, we need to give this away. And I go to a meeting and I look to see who needs a hug today, who needs to sit and talk. Who needs something? See, because if you plant corn, you get corn. You plant wheat, you get wheat. You plant hope, kindness, tolerance, love, understanding in the hearts of somebody else, the heart, particularly of a newcomer. You bring that into your own world. The Muslims have a saying, you can't take somebody else's boat to shore without taking your own boat to shore. So in my 10th step, I call my life into question every day before I go to bed. I ask God, you know, can I be a better man tomorrow? What do I need to do today? What did I do today to help me be a better man tomorrow? In my 11th step, man, prayer and meditation, I could probably share for 40 days on prayer and meditation and not repeat myself. But there's a couple of forms of meditation. The first of it all begins with silence. It begins with me just being still and knowing God. Be still and know that I'm God. Just be still and be quiet. And I have the most interesting shit roll through my head. I don't always agree with it, but I find it interesting as hell. And that's part of my meditative process. Being able to still my mind is one part of my meditation. The other part is I'll take something from the basic text. I'll take a piece of scripture. I'll take a line from a writing out of somebody's spiritual writings. And I'll think about it all day. I'll meditate. I'll chew it around. I'll see how it plays out in my life. And that's a form of meditation. But one of the practices that I love out of this 11th step is what I call the principle of remembrance. I remember every act of kindness that was done for me. I try to remember who fed me, who gave me a ride to meeting, who listened to me, who sat with me when Susie died, who gave me a hug when I was just bawling my eyes out, who loved me, who showed me love. I want to remember that, because when I remember that, it fills me with gratitude. It fills me with a desire to give this to somebody else. It's like I'm going to explode if I don't give it to somebody, if I don't give it away, because I just remember how kind and loving people have been to me in this fellowship. And why is that important? Because that addict that I talked about early on, who's waking up sick, who's sitting in prison, the baby being born, the woman doing a sex act for somebody for dope, the person, you know, whose next shot's going to be the last shot, or the person who's going to take their own life today because of this disease. Man, that's why I get that gratitude. That's why I fill myself with love in the 11th step, because you and I, we get to carry the most powerful message a sick and suffering addict can hear. We do recover through God, the 12 steps, and the 12 traditions in a loving fellowship called Narcotics Anonymous. Thanks for letting me share that. And if you're a newcomer, man, stay. We'll tell you, keep coming back. I'm telling you, stay. Don't go anywhere. We love you. Thanks for letting me share. Hello?
Yeah, well, I got you.
All right.
Bob?
Yes.
We're a little bit early.
Okay. Well, let me talk about love in another way then.
Okay.
Let me talk about the first tradition. A house divided cannot stand. When you start saying they are this, they do this, they do that, you lose the we. We are a we fellowship. Unity is the principle of our first tradition. And let me tell you how that works. I told you I was married for 40 years. It was my wife and I's practice to take the first hour of our day for each other. I would get up in the morning. I'd go put the coffee on. I'd do my prayers and meditation. She would come out, and we would spend the next hour uninterrupted. We got up an hour earlier than anybody in the house got up. We didn't take any phone calls. We shared with each other. We gave the first part of our day to God, and we gave the next part of our day to each other, because we both had pretty stressful jobs. And by the end of a day, we didn't want to really, you know, try to decide what we were going to do. We tried to make those decisions in the morning when we were fresh. But the one morning I walked out into the living room, and my wife still smoked when we got married. I didn't smoke. And I smelt the stale cigarette smoke, and I decided right then and there that she was going to quit smoking. And I've got skills. So when she came out, I said to her, honey, I got to talk to you. She said, oh, my God, what's wrong? I said, well, I want to talk to you about your health. And she said, my health. And then my mouth disengaged from my brain, and I started. I go to kiss you, your breast smells. you know, there's dirty ashtrays around here. You burn little holes in the furniture. It's like taking money and rolling it up and setting it on fire. And I say my best one for last. I said, you set a lousy example for the kids and the grandkids. And she told me to do something that's physically impossible for me to do to myself. But I didn't get all upset because I have a sponsor. And I went up to my sponsor later in the morning and I laid this whole scenario out. I told her about the breath. I told her about the burning the holes. I told her about the money. I told her about it. My sponsor said to me, you know what, Bob? You're right. You are absolutely right. But if you keep that dumb shit up, you're going to be the most rightest, alonest person in Narcotics Anonymous. See, do you want to be right or do you want to be together? See, we can overcome our mistakes. What we can't overcome is if we divorce from each other, if we separate from each other. You know, I learned in that tradition to value the relationships that I have more so than who's right or wrong. I know if you spend an hour with me, I'll piss you off enough that you'd have cause to divorce me if we were married. And I know that you would do that to me. But our unity requires that we practice that eighth and ninth step, this process of reconciliation, to be able to maintain the unity. And our fellowship and in our country today, man, there's so much dissension. There's so much we and they and people not talking to each other. And you know, we as addicts can't afford that, man. Our first tradition talks about unity. If I would not have learned that, if I had not learned to value that relationship with the woman that I loved, I would never have been able to maintain a relationship for 40 years. You know, in the second tradition, we talk about a loving God. See, you know, we get to choose a God of our own understanding, but our common God, the God that we all share together, is the loving God. And when I married Sue, I was an either or person. You do this or I'll do that. You either do this or I'm going to do that. I grew up like that. I had to have my sponsor show me how to bring God into my relationships, how to be gentle, how to be kind, how to be loving, even how to touch a woman, not grab her, but touch her gently, talk, how, engage the person that you love in the decision-making process that you are going to make, not being the king, not saying you're going to do this and this is what we're going to do, but what should we do, honey? Well, let's figure this out together. And that's part of our second tradition of being able to communicate, being able to recognize the loving God in each other. I like to say that Sue and I used to invite the child in each other out to play. You know, my childhood was not very good, but you know, when I met Sue, she taught me to bring out that loving child inside myself and to be in awe and wonder of God, to be in awe and wonder of life. If you watch kids and they're playing, they're like, oh man, did you see this? You know, I learned in my second tradition to approach life like that, to awe, to be amazed at the sunsets, to be amazed at the sunrise in the morning. I'm up early. People know me. I do a post. I'm up early because I love watching the sun come up. I love greeting a new day. I love to be filled with awe. And I have always had a mind that wonders how things are done, why people do what they do, how things work. Awe and wonder are things in my second tradition of that loving God and learning how to communicate with other people out of those sense of my spirituality rather than my humanness. In the third tradition, we talk about desire. You know, when we get here, we're not lovable. I didn't feel loved. I didn't think I was worthy of love. And consequently, when you don't think that somebody loves you, you can get jealous, you can get controlling, you can squeeze the life out of somebody. You know, they talk about if you have a bird in your hand, let it open your hand and let it fly. And if it comes back, it's yours forever. If you squeeze it too hard, you crush it. If you squeeze the person that you love too hard, if sometimes we try to control a person because we're afraid of our own loneliness. We're afraid of our own lack of self-worth, our own self-esteem. You need to work around. We tell people don't get into new relationships in the first year. I don't know many people that are successful with that, but it makes us, you know, glad to tell you that. Don't get into a relationship for the first year. What I'd rather tell you is get a meeting list and get names on the back of that meeting list. So when that deep, hot, loving, meaningful relationship ends, that you have some people to call. Because we all go through a bunch of bad relationships before we find the relationships that really mean something to us. And, you know, we say to the newcomer, we will love you until you love yourself. You know, it's important to love yourself because you can't give away something you don't have. You just can't give away something you do not have. And so in that third tradition, we learn that people want to be with us. People love us. We are lovable, and we are capable of loving other people. And that comes out of that third tradition. So in the first tradition, we learn unity. In the second tradition, we learn to communicate that unity and bring a loving God into our relationships. And in the third one, we learn to love ourselves, to value ourselves, and to love freely without power and control. How am I doing time-wise?
Whenever you're ready, it's up to you.
I've about exhausted my message. Right. If you want me to go back into the steps, I can. If you want to ask me a question about a step, I'm happy to share on it.
No, it's up to you. If you're done, then you're done.
I'm done.
Okay. Well,
thanks for letting me share.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bob.
You know, while we have a moment here, our History and Archives Committee put together a little video, and they're going to be unhappy if I don't share it with you guys. So before we go to close this, let me run this little video for you guys. Okay. At this point, I'd like to turn it back over to Bob M. And he's got something to read. Bob, are you able to?
Yeah.
Oh, there you go.
Do you want me to read just for today?
No, it's first, there's a little part there for you on the format.
I don't have the format. I have just for today on my screen.
He's referring to Bob Stewart.
Okay, it's Bob S. then. I'm sorry.
All right, thank you.
We got two Bobs. A little bit confusing.
All right, can you hear me now?
Yes, sorry about that.
All right. Once again, we'd like to thank the speaker, Bob M. from Pennsylvania, and all of the people that read tonight. And with that, we will turn it over to Matt S., the program person.
All right. Thank you, Bob S. and Bob M. and all those that read tonight. We have a few minutes left. So I guess we could open it up to share for 5 minutes or so. Somebody would like to share for about 5 minutes? Let's see what we got here. How about Cynthia P?
Hello, Billy. My name is Cynthia P, and I'm from Joliet, Illinois, clean day 12/14/93. I want to give thanks to Power Grid and myself and welcome all the new people and congratulate all of you all for your selfless service work. And there's one thing about service work. It will show if I was selfless or not. This was so awesome. You guys did such a wonderful job. I'm telling you, I am filled to the brim. Now, the love piece. When our founder met with the other founder, and they joined in from the word empathy. And as we know, empathy is understanding with experience. And that brought about the connection of love. Right there. Right there. That love is so powerful in our fellowship. It really, 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 really is. In the introduction in the Guiding Principle book, Robert already shared everything else. This is the only thing he didn't share. He should have been in love. It said that we need every principle, every resource, and every member. If that's not love, what is it? My name is Cynthia P., and thanks for letting me share.
All right. Thank you, Cynthia. We have time maybe for one more short one. Catherine, can you share for a few minutes?
Me?
Sure, why not?
Unmute her.
I went to go unmute myself and the screen flipped and I think I asked somebody else to unmute. My name is Catherine. I'm an addict. And, you know, this has been like really a great experience so far. You know, it's kind of like bittersweet because it's just not nearly as tiring just sitting here in a chair all day long. And there's some like weird experience that all of us on convention committee know about, that exhaustion that hits really right about this time of night. And then you get bombarded in the registration booth for people that couldn't get into the banquet or the main meeting room. And it's so nice that at least with this experience that you know what? Everybody has an ability to be on this main meeting that wants to be. So, you know, that is just really awesome. You know, for me, so many good things happen this time of year. You know, people that are on the committee with me know, like 3 years ago, I spent my entire, you know, convention weekend on baby watch with my daughter that started on Thursday night, who had a baby Sunday morning. So, you know, I'm just so grateful that this program gives me the ability to, like, participate in those things. And one other thing I'll say really quick, that probably my entire best experience of this convention ever was when I sat in the Friday night meeting with my son, who was 6 months clean. And it was just like the thrill of my lifetime. And you know what? I was so grateful for that. And I'm grateful to have been a member of this committee for so long. And I think that just will about wrap it up.
All right. Thank you. All right. So at this time, I'd like to thank all the readers and speakers and our leader again. And I guess we'll now turn it over to Aaron S. to read Just for Today as soon as it comes up. Let me see. Oops. Aaron, you should be able to unmute now.
My name is Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
Just for today, tell yourself, just for today, my thoughts will be on my recovery, living and enjoying life without the use of drugs. Just for today, I will have faith in someone in NA who believes in me and wants to help me in my recovery. Just for today, I will have a program. I will try to follow it to the best of my ability. Just for today, through NA, I will try to get a better perspective on my life. Just for today, I will be unafraid. My thoughts will be on my new associations, people who are not using and who have found a new way of life. So long as I follow that way, I have nothing to fear.